Hello, and welcome to Primary Sources, a production of the Central Arkansas Library System, where we focus on people making a difference in Little Rock and Arkansas. Some you might have heard of, and some you haven't heard of, but probably want to know about. Check out cals.org/podcasts for more Primary Sources interviews.
Welcome to a special edition of Primary Sources, a podcast of the Central Arkansas Library System. I'm Matt DeCampbell, and this is episode 2 of our look at the 2018 Arkansas Literary Festival. This episode focuses on 3 authors who will be visiting Arkansas for the first time from out of state, bringing their works and their stories to the festival. We start with Carmen Bulosa, a renowned Mexican writer who has recently translated a work she wrote decades ago into English. It is called Heavens on Earth. It is about perspective and history from a number of different angles and has before been a source of some controversy. Obviously, you've had a pretty storied career of writing, but this particular book feels like kind of a new approach to storytelling for you.
Well, I wrote the book in 1994 and 1995, which is...
24, yeah.
It was for me like natural after the other books I have written that mainly have not been translated into English. But I had done a novel called Llanto, that's Moctezuma, the last emperor of the Aztecs, appearing in the middle of Mexico City in the 80s, being picked up by some girls. And so it was like trespassing the walls of time, to say so, going back and forth in the walls of time. And in this novel, what I did was, let's not trespass them. Let's think they all live in the same floor without mingling them, without mixing them, just saying they all occupy the same, not the same space, but yes, the same territory.
Yeah.
They have the same floor. Anemical, sorry for my English.
It's all right. It's far better than my Spanish.
So they occupy a same atmosphere, but they do have very different environments. So that's what I tried to capture. And that's why none of their stories could be complete, could have a complete beginning, a complete development, and a complete ending. Because when you are in a domestic space, I use the idea of a floor like in a building.
Sure.
Every apartment in its domesticity contains a present, an atmosphere. Cities where buildings are occupied by hundreds of different families or different groups or different individuals. And they all capture or try to capture the present where they establish themselves there. And they did not remain in the house of their parents, and they are not living it or normally or before Trump came and abolished Social Security, which would happen. They don't live in the home of their children. They live in their own present, in their own territory. So that's what I wanted to do with the 3 characters. Exactly in the 3 layers of the novel, exactly in the moment where their worlds are about to be blown.
Yeah.
To be blown up.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So when you originally visited these stories in the 80s, were they published in Spanish, or was it something you kind of put on the shelf until now? Okay.
All the novels before have had a very warm reception, and this one was, the reception was very strange. As strange as always my plays had been received. All my plays, I wrote many theater pieces, and I staged them, or they were staged, many of them, meaning like a dozen or even more, and they were always very controversial. There was once in the 80s, I did a play called Cooking Men, Cocinar Hombres. The day we opened it, half the audience loved it, But first, between part one and part two of the play, half the audience left.
Oh.
And at the end, the ones that had remained stood up and clapped. They adored it. Every day that we had the show on stage, every time we did it, the same thing happened. Half the people liked it and half the people hated it. Do I like that? No, I don't like that. I am not person of, I don't like to be in the middle of a ring arena. It's not in my nature.
You're not looking for the controversy. It just happens.
I like to do something and then move on to the next.
Mm-hmm.
And in the case of this novel, it wasn't unanimously loved. It was divided. I was not attacked, as it did happen in the play, because novels are different.
Sure.
The readers drop in a different way. The theater is, you have the response in the minute. Now, the day we opened The Cooking Men, the play, I was giving you the comparison.
Right.
The day we opened it, when we were at the very, very end, I said to my then partner and he rests in heaven or in hell many years ago.
Mm.
So with this novel, it came out and it was a strange reaction. It was not like all my former novels. They were saying like, what the hell? What did you do this? I did what was natural for me and I did what I thought was proper and I did what I wanted to do and I love the novel.
Mm-hmm. So then why...
I'm telling you, like, I'm going all the way there.
Yeah.
When Will Evans from Deep Vellum told me, we're going to publish it, the translation, I said, don't! don't do it! You won't sell copies! It's a tough book. And he told me, you like it or not? And I told him, I love it.
So what...
How has the
translated version been received as compared to the original version?
I try not to look. I'm the worst person to ask. I'm in another world. I'm doing my next novel.
Yeah.
That's what I do. When I was young, when the books were in my own language, I had to look on reception. Maybe that's why I stopped doing theater. And I love to work, and I love my work. I love the adventure is so rewarding. There's always something there. It's not that I invent them. I always think it's like the writer is a thermometer of what's going on, or even more than a thermometer, an archaeologist that is feeling what has been done by others already. And you just dig and have to be careful and don't destroy.
Yeah.
To figure out what all have done already. With, of course, it's your work. But your work is always related with something that's going on in the present. So I'm always absorbed.
So in the novel, you examine a lot about historical perspective and how that changes through history and how it, you know, stays relevant through time. Is that something that you kind of revisited with this translation of it? Because you mentioned earlier that the past few years have been very different for a lot of people, especially when you're talking about immigrant families. Did you just take it and straight translate it, or did you kind of take a moment to look at kind of the current historical perspective? Mm-hmm.
And she did the whole work of it. I did no rewriting. I let her go. Now, today in the morning, not because you were going to interview me, but only by chance, I reread a play that I love of Lope de Vega, one of the contemporaries of Cervantes,
mm-hmm.
maybe the most successful of his time, or I was told at college he was the most successful author of his times, but now I know that it was a woman of whom nobody speaks, that is called Maria de Sayas, that did a Cervantes novelas, short novels, and she was the most read author of her time, and after, when she became old and passed away, nobody ever spoke again of her. I love her work, but let's put her aside.
Okay.
Lope de Vega. Today I was looking for something in his place, And I reread a beautiful piece he has on the origin of mankind. It's a very, very, he's a terrific author. And there he tells in his personal mythology of what the past of the Occidental man is. He's contemporary of Shakespeare.
Mm.
And it's so fascinating how he arranges chronologically and builds his own origins from Dido, from the Greek gods to the god of the holy god of the Mediterranean to it's extraordinary. We all need to relate to our past. Immigrants do, and non-immigrants do also. And when a country tries to not to look at its past, starts eating other countries. And that is the case of this one. But let's not talk about this one.
We don't have to get into a lot of detail. We'll be here all day. Obviously, we're going to be thrilled to have you been to Arkansas before?
Never, never, never.
Well.
So, honestly, I accepted the invitation because I've never been there, and it's a mythical place for me that I've never seen with my own eyes, and I do not want to really imagine till I'm there.
There you go. Well,
it'll be for me all a surprise. I'm delighted I'll be there. And let's hope all works, and let's hope I'm able to speak a comprehensible language.
Well, I'm sure you'll do fine, and I'll be interested to hear your impressions when you make it.
Okay.
But thank you for taking the time, Carmen. Corey Stamper pulls back the curtain to show us the maybe unexpected drama and intensity behind the compilation and printing of dictionaries. Her book, Word by Word, looks at how words become definitions and reveals some surprising things you might not know about the English language. So obviously, when I think about drama and intrigue, I think about lexicography. So, you know, share with the world why dictionaries are a far more intriguing world than they think they might be.
Well, there are a few different reasons why. First is the atmosphere itself of the office is sort of its own weird, sui generis kind of place. Like, we, until the mid-90s, for instance, there was a formal rule of silence at the dictionary company where there was no talking. There's also lots of drama in terms, you know, people feel so strongly about language. Language is so personal. So things like definitions of the word marriage, for instance, or definitions of the phrase assault rifle get people really riled up because they have very strong views on what marriage is or what constitutes an assault rifle. And they're, you know, they share them with you loudly and often. And sometimes they send threatening letters to the office, or sometimes they, you know, beg you to change things. So it's a very, you wouldn't think it would be quite so dramatic, but it gets dramatic.
Yeah. So what was the main motivation behind the monastery rule, for lack of a better term, for so long?
Well, I mean, part of it is the nature of defining itself. It's so brain twisting. It is so, it just takes all of your mental energy to write a definition, because you have to keep all of these different rules in mind, and every word that you use matters. You can't just, you know, cobble something together and say, oh, that's good enough. You really have to weigh carefully each word you use. And so it's often easier to do that in silence, because the last thing you want is to be, you know, two words away from the Platonic ideal of a good definition and have someone talking about, you know, the latest, you know, Red Sox score walk past your cubicle and now it's gone.
Right.
So the nature of the work itself requires quiet. So, you know, it's loosened up a little bit. Now people whisper in the office.
Oh, good. They've got something.
Yeah.
So and you talk about some of the external response and passions that you get to definition and word. Are there stories in the book about the lengths and heights that some of the internal conflicts rise to?
There are some stories in the book about that. Though, you know, it being a silent office, those conflicts within the office tend not to be all that voluble. People, you know, like, they tend to happen over email or notes, and they tend to happen over decades in some cases, because that's how long it takes to go through and define all the words for a dictionary. You know, it takes you, it's a 10-year revision cycle. So yeah, there are some stories in the book about how do you deal internally with conflicting views on what a word means, or should a word get a label that, you know, should a word get a label that says it's disparaging or offensive? And those will, they do, they stretch decades.
Wow. So
yeah.
Do you get the feel that there's, you know, you talk about how passionate people are about words. And the passion of the people who work in lexicography.
Right.
What do you think it is that drives people into that field to not just care about how a word is used or thrown out there, and especially in a language like English, which is such a mishmash of so many, you know,
so
many sources. What do you think continues over the decades to drive people into that?
Well, you know, I think some of it is honestly misguided. Some of it is that people want to protect the language from decay, which is actually, you know, then you get hired and you realize that, you know, the things that you think are decaying the language are actually moving the language forward. They're mm-hmm. keeping it alive.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing. But I think the bigger thing is that, you know, lexicographers just love language, and they love being around it, and they love learning about it. And it's not a job that people sort of, you know, wander into and kind of do for 5 or 6 years and then leave. It's really something that if you do it, you do it forever.
Yeah.
You do it until they carry you out in a box, that kind of thing. So yeah, I think the people who do it, it's really because they love English. And you know, English can be a really fickle mistress. Like, it can be really infuriating sometimes, but even that kind of infuriating part of it can be really, you know, it can be really beguiling.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah.
So in the synopsis, it talks about some of the surprising and offbeat things that you find when researching words. The example of the synopsis being that actually the abbreviation OMG has actually been around for a century. How much of the book is stuff like that? And are there one or two other examples you could tease the listeners with?
I mean, you know, I've tried to sprinkle stuff like that through the whole book because I think that kind of stuff is just so amazing in English that these things are there. And there's a couple of other things. One of my favorites is that the word pumpernickel, if you translate it literally from its German roots, it means fart goblin.
Wow.
That's always a great party bit.
Sure, especially if someone's right. eating an hors d'oeuvre on a piece of pumpernickel.
right. You know, so many words are so much older than we think they are.
Mm-hmm.
The singular they, which, you know, lots of people who are grammar snoots really come down against the singular they. So, you know, the they is used in, like, everyone grabbed their pencil and took the test.
Sure.
But, you know, that singular they goes back to the 1300s and has, you know, actually existed long before the gender-neutral he existed.
Yeah.
So, yeah. What else? What are other? I mean, there's so many other weird, fun things.
Yeah.
English is just a great, weird, fun language.
So, have you ever been to Arkansas before?
I've driven through Arkansas 3 times.
Okay. So you've stopped by.
Which is not helpful.
Right. No, but I mean, obviously you'll be more immersive at LitFest. And for me,
oh, yeah.
It just kind of brings up the whole idea of how much does things like, you know, regional language and regional traditions and speech patterns and things, because, you know, we don't use the singular they, we use the singular y'all down
right.
here. And then if it's a group, it's all y'all. So, I mean, like, how much of that do you see around the country, and how much is that factored in when people are researching and talking definitions?
So what we try and do in producing a general dictionary is we try and get the major regionalisms if we can. So the way that we do that is, you know, we sort of read everything that we can, and we try and focus really strongly on strong regional either publications or authors who we know write in a regional dialect or things like that. Because you really, I mean, regionalisms are hard to get a hold of sometimes because, well, first, you know, local news is kind of dying out at this point. So it's harder to get local newscasters who would use all y'all on TV. And you also have a, particularly as sort of more stuff ends up online, it can actually be harder to find actual regional sources from that area. So this is a good example. I'm living outside of Philadelphia now, and there's a Philly word that I love called John, J-A-W-N, and it's only a Philly word. But if you search like Twitter or social media for it, you'll find people using it from all over the world. But it's not a global thing.
Mm-hmm.
So regionalisms are hard to, they can be really hard to track, but we try hard to catch the big ones. I grew up in Colorado, and I have family all through the, you know, South Midland is what we call it in linguistics. So I'm well aware of all y'all versus y'all.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
That's, like, I know all about that. So, we try and grab regionalisms as much as we can, but, you know, I will be totally geeking out.
Oh, yeah, no, you'll be, you'll have, your cup will be overflowing, I think.
Oh, good.
Yeah, with all kinds of examples and probably even new terms. And when you talk, too, about a lot more news content going online, I have to think, too, that a lot of people don't write the same way that they would speak when you're talking about regionalisms.
Yeah, they don't. And that can be really frustrating in lots of ways. Actually, the one thing that has been great about sort of the proliferation of online stuff is online writing presents this really interesting kind of new hybrid kind of writing where it's, particularly for social media, it's public, anyone can see it,
mm-hmm.
but people write in a much more sort of like a letter-based way. Like they write their social media posts like they're talking to one or two people. And
yeah.
So in that sense, they're a lot more informal. So you can pick up regionalisms if you're really careful.
Yeah.
So but yeah, I mean, you know, the internet has been great for lexicographers, and it's also completely overwhelming for lexicographers. I guess kind of like everybody else, right?
Sure,
like,
sure.
We're all in it together.
Well, and especially now in the world of text messaging and shorthand, and, you know, shorthand being to a level that I can imagine it. And maybe it has been before, but, you know, as far as the ways that people chop up their language, probably can't sit well with many of the folks quietly in their cubicles.
Right, right. I mean, it makes more work for us, which is, you know, it's not a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
Job security is always good.
Yes,
but,
it
you
is.
Know, it definitely makes the puzzle a little bit more convoluted sometimes.
I can imagine. All right. Well, yeah. Get ready for a great time when you come to Arkansas. And
I'm really excited, actually.
Yeah, on many fronts. Yeah.
I actually have some friends of mine who live in Hendricks, and one of my friends teaches at Hendricks, and he's from Washington D.C. area, and he was like, "I love Arkansas so much, Corey." I'm so excited I get to go. So
great.
I'm really excited to be there. Yeah.
Yeah. Conway's a great town, too, if you get a chance to make it up there to Hendricks. So,
yeah.
All right. Well, we look forward to it. And thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, of course. No problem.
All right. We'll talk to you soon. David Giffels is the author of Furnishing Eternity, A Father, A Son, A Coffin, and A Measure of Life, a story about building his own coffin alongside his aging father and the tragic circumstances that followed and redefined his writing experience. All right. I have to ask you first, before we get into the specifics of the book, how does it feel to be dubbed by the New York Times as the Bard of Akron?
It's kind of hard to live down. you sort of can't put that toothpaste back into the tube. So believe me, I've been called that more times in the last 3 months than I would prefer to. It's funny because right after that happened, one of my very good friends was named the Poet Laureate of Ohio. And I kind of felt like he stole my thunder. Like, I finally got a, you know, sort of cool, weird nickname, and then he kind of one-ups it.
Either that, or you guys could start some sort of literary, superhero league or something with all these titles.
Walk around wearing our laurels.
So to get into the book, when you first started this idea of building the coffin, did you have the original idea thinking in the back of your head, okay, this could be a good story to write about someday, or was it until after the tragedies and the other developments that occurred that you found the book in the experience?
It was sort of in between. You know, the idea came up of building a casket with my dad came up more or less spontaneously and in sort of semi-harebrained fashion. And then once it took hold, and really the reason it took hold was not so much that I was itching to build my own coffin as it was I was looking for a way to spend time with my dad as he was entering his 80s, and we had spent so much meaningful time together building things for all our lives that I was really just looking to do something with him. And once it sort of became clear that we were actually going to do this, yeah, the writer part of me was like, I think that would be a pretty interesting thing to write about. The idea of mortality as a theme was more or less theoretical at the beginning, and it wasn't until about a year into it that first one and then another of the people that were closest to me died. And so this idea of a theoretical meditation on mortality took on completely different flavor and life of its own.
And it feels like throughout the process, you tried to make sure that levity was part of your examination of mortality.
Yeah, a lot of that comes from my dad and my mom. Both of them had very irreverent senses of humor. And, you know, I was just, I guess I'm just sort of tuned that way in great part by them. So, yeah, I mean, I wanted to try to probe the big questions, but I don't feel like I'm the one to probe them with the big guns. It was more just a way to think about it the way my mind works.
Yeah, makes sense. I'm much the same way. Although I'm not the bard of anything. So I guess talk about how the experience changed. I assume you started out with the idea of it being your coffin, that because that would be more acceptable to your dad than say, you know, let's build your coffin, Dad. How did it kind of grow and evolve as you lose your mother and then lose your best friend as well?
I should know this by now as a writer that when you get an idea and you think you're in control of an idea, you're kind of a fool, because every idea, especially big project kind of idea that I've ever had, has proved to have a life of its own and kind of told me what it wanted to be rather than me deciding what it was going to be and then, you know, sort of entering with that full authority. And so to take on like one of the big topics and one of the, you know, sort of dangerous topics in a way of death and grief, I, you know, thought I was in control of it until I found out I wasn't. And then it was a much different, it was definitely the hardest writing challenge I've ever faced, and also much different than any writing challenge I've ever faced, which was to, you know, I was actively writing the book when first my mother died and then my best friend a year later died. And in both cases, I had to work through the actual real life personal grief of losing people, but also the challenge of trying to write about something that's so hard to grasp in the moment and hard to sort of see the shape of things, because grief is so ever changing and chaotic and in some ways violent, and yet storyteller has to control form and meaning and tone and all of that. And so it took a lot of work and a lot of time and a lot of revision and drafting to to really try to get those parts of the story to work.
And once the story was published, it feels like that this is the type of book that you're going to get a lot of personal reaction to from readers, as far as having relatable experiences or kind of trying to meld your experience with similar ones that they have. Have you seen and heard and felt a lot of that since the book came out?
Yeah, very much. I mean, I've had a lot of conversations and email correspondences with people who've read the book or read about the book, and who've lost people, who've lost parents especially, or, you know, come to some sort of confrontation with the fact that their parents are not going to live forever, you know, those sorts of things that don't, I think for most adults who lose parents in middle age, it's like you don't really understand that you or anyone close to you is mortal until one of those people is touched by it, and then all of a sudden your perspective just comes ratcheting around in this way that you're like, how could I never have thought about this before or recognized this before? So it's a strange experience. When I told my agent that my mother had died and we were talking about it, he said when you lose a parent, you find yourself suddenly on the gangplank. And I thought that was that really kind of hit home for me, because it's like you know, I thought I was, you know, sort of immortal or somehow, you know, Sweepy in the Popeye cartoon goes crawling through all these dangerous situations,
right,
and he always just sort of lands magically onto the next I-beam in the construction zone or whatever.
Yeah.
And you feel that way until all of a sudden the I-beam falls away and then you're hanging in midair.
Was part of your intention with the book to try to give some people some of that perspective or a taste of it before they find themselves in that situation where they've lost a parent?
Yeah, I mean, I it's weird because I've written two memoirs and a book of personal essays, but I'm still not entirely comfortable writing about myself as a subject unless I can approach it that I'm telling a story that will be either useful for other people or that they can at least recognize some version of their own experience in it. So I was, yeah, I mean, as personal as this book is, I also was trying to write it as generously as I could to show what it feels like to grieve this way and what it feels like to lose people in this way. And I mean, a book that was really important to me, especially after my mother died, was Joan Didion's The Year of Magical Thinking. And that book was incredibly therapeutic for me to read somebody else's version of what it feels like in the first days and then weeks and then months of an intense loss like that. And so I wanted, I mean, I would never, you know, sort of even whisper that I was trying to reach the example of Joan Didion, but I definitely wanted to do with my book what her book did for me, you know, with the hope that it would somehow give somebody else at least some idea of either what they're in for or some reflection of what they're going through. And that's been the most rewarding thing, is to hear from people then who have connected with it that way.
I can imagine. So if you can tell me without giving away any big spoilers, how did the coffin turn out, and where do you store that, your own coffin?
The coffin, it's funny because we got into this thing and it's as the book kind of narrates, it took us 4 years to finish it, but it probably only took us, you know, a couple months. We kept stopping and starting, and it kept changing, and we kept coming up with new ideas. So the coffin turned out a little bit more overwrought than it needed to be.
Yeah.
And the beauty of it is we got done with it, and that's kind of where the book ends. But after we finished, my dad said, not long after, he turned to me and he said, well, we made all the mistakes on yours, now I'm going to make my own the right way.
Aha.
And he went right back into his workshop, and in a couple of months he built this much more beautifully conceived and simple, kind of rustic but elegant pine box for himself that, you know, sort of took all the lessons. So I felt like the accomplishment that we made was in getting him a much better box than mine will be. Mine is, it's been transformed. It's a rectangular box, so it stands on end, and it's fitted with temporary shelves, so it's a bookcase.
Oh!
If you walked through my house, you would walk right past it, and you would have no idea that that was my casket. And then it can very easily, those shelves are removable, so someday when it has to be converted to its ultimate purpose, the shelves will come out, and it'll be laid back down, and there it goes.
Do you keep books in that shelf that you may want to be buried with someday?
Yeah, well, actually, it's kind of taken on a life of its own in the house, because we first put, my wife and I, put family pictures of people we lost in it as a way to, for it to be sort of a, you know, kind of a little shrine and have some meaning in that. And it has kind of gathered now, it's become a magnet for oddball bits of family memorabilia and sometimes jokes. And the best thing that's in it right now or on it right now is when we had the book launch event at the Akron Library. It was in an auditorium, and the first two rows were reserved seats, and the library staff took my publicity headshot, and they made these little cards that said reserved for our special guest, and they were laminated, and they were taped to all of the chairs in the first two rows. And so my wife kept one of those, and she stuck it to the side of the casket, so there's this thing that says reserved for our special guest face on it. Completely different meaning in that context, obviously. So it's things like that have kind of made it become this weird eyeball fun part of our household.
Well, I hope it's a good headshot, at least.
Let's put it this way. I hope someday it'll be a much younger and better-looking version of whatever self I am at the point.
Absolutely.
My demise.
So to wrap up, I'm going to skew a little bit off subject, but not completely. You obviously, you know, write kind of from a perspective of honesty and sincerity, but like you said, with some irreverence and kind of a skewed comedic view on a lot of things. And how much of that influence came from working with Mike Judge, being one of the most unique, you know, perspectived and comedic minds of the generation?
Daily basis, but definitely we interacted. And one of the best pieces of writing advice I ever got was when I was early on when I started writing for the show, I would like pitch ideas and work on scripts, and I was trying to be like, I had a master's degree in English, and so I was trying to be like really like sort of overtly clever. It's like the Noel Coward of being. So I would write these scripts or these jokes or these lines that were just overdone. And I remember, and this was pre-email, so like
sure.
A lot of our correspondence would take place by fax machine. And I remember him sending me a fax one day of responding to something that I sent it to him, and it just said, "Make it stupid." And now, like, the longer I go on, the more I revert to that. But when I'm writing or when I'm struggling with something, I'm like, "Just make it stupid. You know, you're trying too hard." And so, yeah, definitely that. And plus, what was great about that show was its understanding of authenticity. That Beavis and Butthead would never do anything out of character, because he really understood the pure authenticity of what those characters were supposed to do and be. And he was smart enough to trust his instincts instead of trying to trust his, you know, his intellect.
Yeah.
And that's true. I mean, you know, in trying to write about death and grief and mourning in an authentic way, those same kinds of lessons, you know, just go back to what's in your gut and don't try so much to try to force meaning into something that's already, you know, it comes custom built with its own meaning. You don't have to
right.
inject it into it.
Well, great. Well, we look forward to having you down here.
Looking forward to it.
Yeah.
I've never been to Little Rock and really looking forward to seeing it.
We'll be interested in your impressions, and please wear your Bard of Akron sash so that everyone can identify you.
If I could wear it anywhere, it would be at the Arkansas Literary.
We hope so. All right. Well, thank you, David. I appreciate the time.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Primary Sources, a production of the Central Arkansas Library System. For more information, please visit cals.org and butlercenter.org. Join us next time to hear more from people making a difference in Little Rock and Arkansas.